From Louisiana to North Dakota, New Mexico to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, wildfires have devastated California. Have government policies contributed to the severity of the disaster? Greg Wrightstone, author of Inconvenient Facts, is here to discuss. Congress returns to session this coming week for a lame duck session that includes a December 7th deadline for funding the federal government. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. The fallout from Amazon's decision to split its new second headquarters between Northern Virginia and New York City continues. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine offers some thoughts on how the process unfolded. And more states have opened new investigations into the growing sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Two major wildfires have inflicted historic damage on communities throughout California. A debate is underway as to whether federal and state environmental policies have made the situation worse than it might otherwise have been. Greg Wrightstone is author of the book Inconvenient Facts, The Science Al Gore Doesn't Want You to Know. He is here to discuss the problem. Greg, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Greg, as we look at the latest two wildfires in California, obviously a tragedy of historic proportions, but as we look at wildfires in the Golden State, are they becoming more frequent?
If you go look at from the data we see from CAL FIRE, which administers all things related to fire in California, fire data shows that we've been in a more than 30-year decline in the numbers of fires, and actually they've been declining significantly. According to their data, we're about 50% number of fires per year is what we were 30 years ago. Looking at the acreage burned, it's interesting. There's been a slight increase. So just looking at those two things, it shows that while there's been a decline in numbers, each fire has nearly doubled in size. And we see that anecdotal data appears to support the notion that the intensity of each fire is increasing. And I think we can trace that right back to forest management practices. If we look at the basics of wildfire, we see that there are three main ingredients for wildfire. That's ignition, it's fuel, and then it's aridity or drought. All three things need to be in place. And a lot of man's actions have actually negatively impacted all three. It's estimated that 95% of the wildfires in California are human caused, and most of those are electrical lines. You might have the odd crashing drunk into a pole that might cause fire, but most of these are human caused. And with more people building more homes out in the hinterlands and fire prone areas, you would expect the number of fires to increase, but in fact they have decreased.
So the number of fires are decreasing, the amount of acreage is increasing. Is part of this, and you mentioned ignition is one of the key factors, obviously, in having a forest fire or any fire. The fact that California has had an exploding population, there are more people there, is that just creating more opportunity for accidents to happen that start these fires?
It is, but what's really curious is that the number of fires have declined. You would think with more people, more sources, more ignition possibilities that the number would increase. We see just the opposite. And it could well be that it's owing to increased soil moisture content. We have seen that across the Northern Hemisphere, that warming temperatures and increasing CO2 are actually dampening fires across the Northern Hemisphere. We see that across the United States. Studies across, extensive study recently across the Northern Hemisphere, Asia, Europe, North America, showed that the number of acres burned by forest fires were in a significant decline and have been for more than 100 years.
President Trump, as you alluded to earlier, he did come out and say that forest management and the fact that California places a lot of restrictions on logging and clearing has contributed to this. Even California Governor Jerry Brown seems to be sort of somewhat reluctantly agreeing with that by changing some policies. Is that what you're seeing in your research as well, as the fact that logging isn't occurring, that underbrush clearing isn't occurring? Is that contributing to the intensity of these fires?
It sure looks that way. Sensible forest management in the first half of the 20th century included lumbering, thinning of the forests, grazing, and controlled burns. All those four were the primary forest management practices. And then starting really in the 1960s, but it culminated in 1994 with the Clintons rolling back of lumbering and timbering practices. Of course, we had to save the spotted owl, if you remember that. And so the timbering and interior-controlled U.S. Forest Service lands was curtailed significantly, and that's led to a buildup in trees. The Sierra Nevada Conservancy states that there are five times as many trees as what a healthy forest should have. So if you think about that, each tree is adding more fuel, that's true, but one of the greatest soil moisture loss impacts is the water loss through plants when they're breathing in and out, transpiring, lose tremendous amounts of moisture. So if we have five times too many trees, each one of that is competing for that same scarce water in the soil. Instead of just one tree, now you've got five. So it's actually increasing the aridity of the soil and just exacerbating the problem.
So we have way too many trees per acre, and the state of California has greatly restricted logging. So, Greg, if we were to take a look at public policies, what sort of changes could be made to address these issues?
Well, let's be clear here. The federal government controls most of the at-risk timber areas by the U.S. Forest Service, about 16 million acres controlled by that in the state. And Jerry Brown was correct about this, that it is a federal problem. Most of the lower elevation is privately owned without as many fire problems. It's more grassy areas. I think we should – Ryan Zinke last year instituted some practices going back to what we'd called sensible forest management before. But we were decades getting to where we are now, and you can't turn an aircraft carrier around on a dime. It'll probably take many years to get back to that, what a healthy forest should look like. And you know the environmentalists will be kicking and screaming if they're going to reinstitute timbering and logging in any of these national forests. So it'll be a fight. But like I say, Ryan Zinke, the head of Interior, already started on that a year ago because he's from Montana, and he's seen firsthand out there in Montana similar negative consequences of poorly managed forests.
We are talking with Greg Wrightstone, who is author of the book Inconvenient Facts. And Greg, you're branching out from books to apps for your cell phone. Tell us what that project's all about.
Yeah. We're really excited. We're rolling out a smartphone app. The Android should be ready in the next week. And what we've done is taken each one of the 60 inconvenient facts in the book, and you'll have one for each one of those. So you'll have a chart at your fingertips that's fully sourced and referenced. I'm creating videos for each one of those, and we've got a YouTube channel. You can go see some of the interesting videos we've got out there. That's YouTube channel Inconvenient Facts. And in fact, I've got a real interesting one on the correlation between witch hunts and temperature in the late Middle Ages. And there is a correlation there, Loman.
And if we have listeners who would be interested in getting the book Inconvenient Facts or possibly downloading your app, where can they do that?
Well, the app will be we're targeting December 15th to have it available. It'll be called Inconvenient App. We're in the testing phase now and still finishing it up. You can go to my website, inconvenientfacts.xyz, for information on forest fires. I've got a page dedicated to that. I've got a blog page. I've got a commentary on the California fires with charts and information there. And of course, the book Inconvenient Facts is always available on Amazon or at that website, inconvenientfacts.xyz.
Greg Wrightstone, author of Inconvenient Facts. Greg, thank you for being here.
You betcha.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, of course, has kept an eye on all the elections this year. They are now, for the most part, over, and we are looking at the return of Congress for a lame duck session. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Congress back until the end of the year, so we have, what, 4 or 5 weeks for them to still accomplish something. And one of those somethings is the fact that we have yet another budget deadline looming. When is that, and what is the situation?
Yeah, the deadline is December 7th, and like the last time we talked about this, if they can't pass a budget by December 7th, then the government shuts down. Nothing good really ever happens in a lame duck session, but this is no exception. Congress is going to reconvene shortly after Thanksgiving, and then they're going to attempt to pass a huge budget. They may even attach a bloated farm bill to it, and maybe even attach some tax extenders, which is basically loopholes for politically connected corporations. So it's going to be pretty ugly this December, but unfortunately, there's not going to be much that we can do about it.
Last year, of course, Andy, we had that terrible omnibus spending bill that just busted all the budgets. The president even said he wouldn't sign another one of those. We shall see in the coming weeks. But any efforts underway in Congress to try to reel in all this spending?
Well, yes, there is. You know, Rand Paul in the Senate introduced a bill called the Penny Plan. And the Penny Plan's been around for a while, but it's time to start looking at it seriously since we're approaching $1 trillion annual deficit. What the Penny Plan does is basically cut one penny for every dollar of federal spending, or 1%. And you keep doing that until you balance the budget. The way that the budget is currently constructed, all you need is 5 years of doing this. So I think it's a very smart thing to do. I think the voters support it, even Democrats and Republicans. And I think that they need to make the tax cuts permanent rather than passing tax extenders. Those two things, making the tax cuts permanent and the Penny Plan, I think are what Congress needs to focus on in the lame duck.
You wouldn't think that cutting just one penny out of every dollar would be all that difficult. We will see how far that goes. As we look at all this spending, there's also the issue of the tax cuts. And there was a lot of talk pre-election, Andy, about tax cuts 2.0, the fact that some of the tax cuts approved a year ago were not permanent. Republicans about to lose the majority. Are they going to try to move that through before they lose that majority?
I would really like to see that happen. But because the Senate does not have 60 votes in order to pass that, I don't think it's going to happen. Another scary thought is that President Trump said that he was willing to work with Democrats on the tax cuts. And one way that he'd be willing to do it is to raise taxes on corporations in order to pay for the individual tax cuts, making those permanent. That, again, even with Trump's support, that can't fly through the Senate, or at least we're hopeful that it can't, because the Democrats would need 60 votes. They're currently at 47, so they would need 13 more squishy Republicans to join with them. I don't see that happening. So hopefully there are no tax increases on the horizon. But unfortunately, there's also not making the tax cuts permanent on the horizon either.
As we look to what might perhaps happen with the onset of a divided Congress, Democrats, of course, will be in a majority in the House of Representatives. Republicans increased their majority in the U.S. Senate in the past election. One thing that conservative Republicans in particular, Andy, have pushed and been successful at was the elimination of earmarks. First of all, could you explain for our listeners what earmarks are and tell us why they're bad and why Republicans did away with them in the first place?
Yeah, earmarks are kind of considered the currency of corruption in Congress. Basically, money spent in somebody's local district, they're usually handed out by appropriators, and they basically use those earmarks to buy votes. So if there's a big, ugly spending bill that you as a congressman don't like, you may vote for it anyways, because in that bill are earmarks for your district, like a bridge or a bike path or a garden or something like that. With the Democrats taking over the U.S. House, it's likely that they're going to remove the ban on earmarks. And the ban has been in place since 2011 when Republicans took over the House. That was a smart move on their part, and I think it's a really dumb move on the part of Democrats to bring them back. What's particularly upsetting about this is that House Republicans are not going to lift the ban themselves. They're going to watch the Democrats lift the ban. And if the voters don't reject the Democrats for lifting that ban, then Republicans are going to partake in the earmarking as well. It's kind of like two kids hanging outside a 7-Eleven, and the Democrat goes in there and shoplifts, and if he gets away with it, the Republican will go in there and steal some candy for himself as well. That's basically how this is setting up. It's not exactly a profile and courage on the part of Republicans to kind of let the Democrats do it first and then see if they can do it themselves.
This sort of brings us back to why Republicans lost control of the House, does it not? I mean, you have Republicans who are acting like Democrats. Does that really allow voters to see a difference? I mean, we saw, what, now close to a 40-seat loss in the House of Representatives. Is this now an opportunity, Andy, for conservative Republicans to start reestablishing what the party stands for in order to try to reclaim that control 2 years from now?
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of members being way too conservative for their district, and yet the voters continually vote that conservative back into office. And the reason why is they may disagree with the congressman on policy, but if he's sticking to his principles, they'll take that over a congressman that goes back and forth on the issues depending on what the political mood is of the day. So I think voters definitely are looking for more honesty and more principled members, regardless of their ideology. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of that in the Republican Party right now.
We will, of course, keep an eye on this over the coming weeks with Andy Roth from the Club for Growth. And Andy, a few words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life. We're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
After a nationwide competition, Amazon decided on Northern Virginia and New York City as sites for what has been dubbed HQ2. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine looks at the policy implications of that competition. Eric?
Amazon has more than 2 billion reasons to be thankful this Thanksgiving Day. That's 2 billion reasons for all the money that will be coming from taxpayers in New York and Virginia to help subsidize the building of Amazon's HQ2. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal, this Thanksgiving weekend edition of American Radio Journal. And let me be the last, probably, to wish you and your family a happy Thanksgiving. It is a very happy Thanksgiving, as I said, for Amazon and for CEO Jeff Bezos. Amazon has landed more than $2 billion in subsidies from New York and Virginia for its new headquarters, its HQ2, which will be split between locations in Queens, New York, and Arlington, Virginia. In the end, it looks like Amazon largely made these decisions for strategic and symbolic reasons that go beyond the specific goodies promised by policymakers in either place. But of course, there were still plenty of goodies to go around. New York is going to give Amazon $1.5 billion in tax breaks and let the company do pretty much whatever it wants with the land that it will occupy in Long Island City. I mean, good luck if you're a small business in Brooklyn getting around the city zoning codes or city building codes, but Amazon will get to do that when it locates its new headquarters there in Long Island City. It will also get to build a private helicopter pad for Amazon executives to use exclusively, despite the fact that New York pretty tightly regulates helicopter traffic in and around the city ever since 9/11. Sadly, about the only thing Amazon isn't getting from New York is the promise from Governor Andrew Cuomo, who said a few months ago that he would change his name to Amazon Cuomo if Amazon ended up coming to New York. Meanwhile, in Virginia, Amazon gets to be close to the halls of power in Congress, close to all the regulators and policymakers in the administration, close to the Pentagon. Amazon provides a lot of web services to the government and the military, so that connection is close as well. And really, what these two locations say, what locating the second headquarters in New York and Virginia say, is that even for a business like Amazon that can really be done from anywhere, indeed, that's the very essence of Amazon, is that you can order something from anywhere and get it shipped to you, right? Location still matters, though. Location clearly matters to Jeff Bezos, who will now get to live and work right in Washington, D.C. He is currently renovating one of the largest and most expensive homes in the city, and of course he also happens to own the local newspaper, The Washington Post. So the decision makes sense on a lot of levels for Amazon. What doesn't necessarily make sense is all of the incentives that New York and Virginia, to say nothing of the dozens of other cities, the ones that threw money at Amazon in an attempt to land the 50,000 promised jobs that come with the HQ2. So let's take a quick look back at some of the biggest and maybe oddest incentives that were thrown Amazon's way. A few that jump out to me, for example, one of them is in Atlanta, where Amazon executives were promised a private lounge at the Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. Atlanta also promised to rename a major street Alexa Way after Amazon's digital personal assistant slash home spying device. The city had also promised Amazon a private car on each train running on the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit system and a way to distribute products around the city. Personally, I'm kind of surprised that Atlanta didn't promise to let Amazon executives have exclusive access to the city's streetcar system to nowhere, since no one really rides that thing anyway. But I think my favorite example of a promise that was made to Amazon by one of these cities that was trying to land the second headquarters comes from Columbus, Ohio. They made the weirdest promise. On top of a $500 million subsidy and a 100% property tax abatement, Ohio's capital city pledged to create a special task force aimed at reducing the city's, quote, unacceptable murder rate. This was probably an attempt to smooth over any concerns that Amazon's bosses may have had about locating in a place where the mayor had literally declared just a few months ago that too many people were getting killed. But residents and business owners in Columbus may be left wondering why reducing the murder rate would be tied to Amazon deciding to move there and not to the well-being of the people and businesses who have to live in Columbus all the time. With Amazon heading elsewhere, is Columbus going to invest fewer resources in reducing murders than it otherwise would have? There's an important lesson in all of this, and some of it's funny, you know, William Shatner doing a video for Chicago or the unacceptable murder rate task force in Columbus, but there really is an important lesson here. City officials ought to put more effort into creating a strong local economy that makes people and businesses want to locate there. That means doing the little things. It means doing the boring things, like trying to limit how many people get murdered in your city, yes, but also things like not wasting tax dollars on silly streetcars. Cities taxing and regulating the living daylights out of incumbent businesses and local entrepreneurs while offering special deals to corporate behemoths is an affront to the people who have actually invested themselves in those cities first without demanding any special exceptions or special tax breaks. Cities should be looking to create a tax and regulatory climate that allows all residents and businesses to prosper rather than cutting special deals that free major corporations from high taxes, oppressive land use policies, or restrictive zoning rules. The real winners in the Amazon sweepstakes are places that ultimately decided not to play, places like San Antonio, Texas, where Mayor Ron Nirenberg last year wrote an open letter to Jeff Bezos saying that it just really wasn't his style to give away the farm to a corporation like Amazon, or a place like Toronto, which did actually bid for HQ2, but declined to offer any sort of special economic development schemes. Frankly, we don't feel like we need to play that game, is how Toby Lennox, the CEO of Toronto Global, described the strategy to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Basically, his argument is that Toronto is doing well enough on its own. Didn't feel like it needed to give Amazon any special tax breaks or special attention. The politicians in places like San Antonio and Toronto won't win any special accolades for creating jobs or really buying jobs, which is how we should describe something like the Amazon deal. But instead of throwing money at the next Foxconn that comes along or the next Amazon or the next Google headquarters or whatever it may be, cities should take a lesson from the Amazon sweepstakes and see that it's not so much about what you can offer to one big corporation, but rather about the sort of environment that you foster for everyone else who's already living and working in the city. And if you're Columbus, Ohio, that means maybe get started on that murder task force pretty soon. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bayman. On behalf of all of us here at Reason and all of us at American Radio Journal, happy Thanksgiving. I'll be back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Ongoing investigations have revealed the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church is far more extensive than initially thought. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College offers his thoughts on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A few weeks ago, I came home and read the grand jury report on sex abuse in six Pennsylvania Catholic dioceses. It's a stunning report with ramifications far beyond the state of Pennsylvania. It's being discussed from coast to coast, continent to continent, from New York to the Vatican. It's an 884-page report. I first went to the specific allegations against priests in my Diocese of Erie and the Pittsburgh Diocese in which I was baptized. I saw names of priests and bishops I know or have met, and I was, of course, mortified. The most heinous case involves an alleged group of four in the Pittsburgh Diocese, which allegedly forced a boy to stand on a bed in a rectory, stripped him, and made him pose as Christ on the cross. They reportedly snapped photos of their victim, which they added to a prized collection of child porn. These devils marked their favorite boy toys with gifts, gold cross necklaces. Imagine, this isn't merely twisted, perverse, psychologically warped, but diabolical. I felt sick to my stomach. If there was a degree of reassurance in the report, however, it was this. In many cases, a good priest or bishop stepped in and took effort to stop the abuse of priests or remove them from ministry. And so many of the abusers have long since passed on. And this included some cases with the much maligned and criticized, deservedly so, Bishop, now Cardinal, Donald Wuerl. And yet, as I work back to the report's introduction, I read this summary statement, which has become the most quoted passage in the media. Quote, "Priests were raping little boys and girls, and the men of God who were responsible for them not only did nothing, they hid it all." Unquote. Stop right there. The latter part of that line outraged me because it isn't what I saw in the report. The very report itself contradicts that. In fact, I found the name of my previous priest, a longtime friend, in the report, and he was not one of the abusers. Quite the contrary, I was gratified to see Father Mark listed for immediately reporting an accused abuser based on just one allegation. He's one of many men of God who did do something, who hid nothing. And yet, good men like Father Mark endure nasty looks of shame when wearing their collar in public out of suspicion they're child molesters. To repeat the line of the report, quote, "Priests were raping little boys and girls, and the men of God who were responsible for them not only did nothing, they hid it all," unquote. That kind of hyperbole is outrageous and it's damaging. It's clear from the language, including some of the remarks by Attorney General Josh Shapiro, who condemned what he called a sophisticated and systematic cover-up aimed at protecting the institution at all costs, that the target is the institutional Catholic Church. This should not be pursued, however, with a broad brush. Too many decent men get smeared. Now, this is not to say that the good work and intentions of the likes of Father Mark were not dealt with effectively enough up the chain of command. The failures were clearly significant. But, in sum, my word of caution, prosecute the abusers, punish them to the fullest extent, and then let the ultimate answer go to God. But please realize that there are so many more fine men who wear the collar and don't engage in such sick depravity. Direct your anger not at them, but at the true abusers. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WGFP-AM in Webster, Massachusetts, WVMM-FM in Grantham, Pennsylvania, along with KCHW-FM in Chewelah, Washington. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.